Very often, an issue is the focus of this show. The U.S. court system 2 weeks ago with Amy Bach, author of Ordinary Injustice. Climate change in Copenhagen next week with Mark Hertzgaard, the environmental correspondent at The Nation magazine. But today, it's not so much one issue as it is a conversation engaging the wide-ranging imagination and activism of my guest, Rebecca Solnit. As we near the end of 1 year and the beginning of another, it's not a bad time to take stock. And Rebecca Solnit thinks and writes and acts about a lot of issues and ideas and their connections. A reviewer of her newest book describes her as, quote, the kind of rugged, off-road public intellectual America doesn't produce often enough. Another writes, quote, although she's written on a vast array of subjects, all her books give new ways to understand the passing world and to glory in it. I recently ran across a couple of articles that she'd written for Tom Dispatch in which she looked back at the end of 2004 and 2005, and then in 2006, one in which she looked back at the present from the year 2025. So settle down as I engage Rebecca Solnit in a wide-ranging conversation about the past year and future decades, about hope and action, about paradise and hell. I could spend the hour, actually, just quoting lines and passages from her compact 2004 book, which I highly recommend, Hope in the Dark, Untold Stories, Wild Possibilities. Here are just a few from the first several pages. This is Rebecca Solnit in Hope in the Dark. Few recognize what a radically transformed world we live in, one that has been transformed not only by such nightmares as global warming and global capital, but by dreams of freedom and of justice, and transformed by things we could not have dreamed of. Another, we need to hope for the realization of our own dreams, but also to recognize a world that will remain wilder than our imaginations. And then this one I really love. Causes and effects assume history marches forward, but history is not an army. It is a crab scuttling sideways, a drip of soft water wearing away stone, an earthquake breaking centuries of tension. And finally, hope is not like a lottery ticket you can sit on a sofa and clutch, feeling lucky. Hope is an axe you break down doors with in an emergency. And then one from her just published, A Paradise Built in Hell, The Extraordinary Communities That Arise in Disaster. The joy in disaster comes when it comes from that purposefulness, the immersion in service and survival, and from an affection that is not private and personal but civic. The love of strangers for each other, of a citizen for his or her city, of belonging to a greater whole, and of doing work that matters. Rebecca Solnit is the author, by my count, of 10 books and co-author of at least 15 more. She's a journalist, essayist, environmentalist, historian, art critic, a contributing editor to Harper's, a columnist for Orion, and a regular contributor to TomDispatch.com and The Nation. She appeals to a wide spectrum of readers. In fact, her 2003 book, this is just evidence of that, River of Shadows, received the National Book Critics Circle Award in Criticism, a prize from the Society for the History of Technology, and Wired Magazine's Rave Award for Book of the Year. Her latest books are Storming the Gates of Paradise, Landscapes for Politics, A Paradise Built in Hell, The Extraordinary Communities That Arise in Disaster, and The Story of the Battle of Seattle, co-authored with her brother David. Welcome, Rebecca Solnit.
Thank you.
Okay. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. So as I said, you're an essayist, an art critic, an author, an activist. How do you describe briefly your path to the work that you do today?
You know, what listeners should also know is that I'm a bit of a flake. I got an invitation to go to West Marin and see endangered coho salmon spawning, and I'm actually standing with my cell phone looking at two salmon right now. And so it may be a little bit different because I'm not where I should be. At how I describe myself, I like being unclassified, and I leave that up to others.
Very well. So you are right.
And the salmon are pretty amazing.
I was just going to say,
You're getting a live report from Lagunitas Creek that probably has never appeared on KPFK before. And last year was terrible for salmon. This year doesn't look too bad.
Why is it better? Do we know?
We're seeing a bunch of. Well, we're having good rain here, which is what brings them back. One theory is that they actually smell the smell of their birthplace washing out to sea and follow that upstream, and the water gives them other benefits. But we've just had a ton of rain, and I've just seen a bunch of salmon.
Okay. So, if listeners, you got that. She's on a cell phone, on a beach, watching salmon spawn.
No, not on a beach. I'm in a forest.
Oh.
A stream in the forest.
Oh, very good. Very good. And there's a point that you're, if your battery runs out, we'll pause the interview for a second, then you'll change phones?
Yes.
Okay. Very good. We'll go to a break if and when that needs to happen.
Okay.
Let me see. As I said to you in our phone call a few days ago and then in the intro, you have written about you've written these end of the year things a few times at Tom Dispatch, and then looking back in the year 2025. That's something that I definitely want to, some of that big stuff I want to do as we move on. But I also want to speak a bit about both Hope in the Dark and A Paradise Built in Hell. Let me just say Hope in the Dark was the first book of yours that I read, and it really struck me. There were pieces of it that I thought, my God, this sounds exact. I mean, you know, in certain ways, it sounds exactly what I'm trying to do. A world that just might work, that sort of thing, and to keep the hopeful solution oriented sort of perspective. How did that book happen?
Well, when the war broke out in 2003, the activists around me surrendered to this kind of not so well-reasoned despair, and that we hadn't stopped the war was absolutely true, that we had changed nothing was not necessarily true, that we never had changed anything was patently untrue, and that we could never change anything was really a pernicious succumbing to despair. And so I felt really compelled to provide alternative histories, to remind people of how uncertain history is, how radical things have been changed by popular power before, and how much scope there is to do it again. And even that war, a number of things had changed because of the global activism. And, so it was really a countermeasure to despair. And at the time, a lot of people embraced it very enthusiastically, although I've been what I jokingly call the Hope Girl for 6 years. I run into a lot of people who are very comfortable, people who are very attached to their despair. So I sometimes refer to it as a book whereby I snatched the teddy bear of despair from the loving arms of the left.
That was going to be actually my next question. Yeah, was that you say some very provocative things about much of the left, and that was one quote there that I was going to mention. What is it you mean when you say the teddy bear of despair?
You know, a lot of people are really attached to despair, and I ran into them, and they're often extremely hostile, and they really just feel very threatened by what I was saying. Sometimes I would be told that being hopeful was lacked solidarity with people who are suffering, although I often ran into people who are in a lot more perilous circumstances and were suffering a lot more, who are a lot more hopeful. The coalition of Mokley workers, the undocumented immigrants who essentially defeated Taco Bell and then defeated McDonald's in their struggle for just pay for farm work, the Zapatistas, and et cetera. And I think, in a funny way, despair gets us off the hook is one part of it. Despair means that you don't really have to do anything because you can't. And so you can, if you're a comfortable middle-class first-world person, you can just go home and, you know, shop or watch TV or be depraved. Another thing is I think that despair is a kind of certainty. People like certainty, I think even terrible certainty, more than they like uncertainty. And hope for me is about uncertainty. It doesn't say that we know that good things will happen, that everything will be okay. That's optimism. Hope for me means that we don't know what will happen and that there is some room to intervene. And, and it's about living in that state of uncertainty.
Right. You mentioned that the very title, Hope in the Dark, you're using dark with two different meanings, right?
Yeah, yes.
So one is that dark, forbidding, treacherous, and so on, but the other is dark, just unknown.
Yeah, and I actually felt like there's a lot of racial connotations to the way darkness is used as a negative, and I wanted to redeem darkness in that sense as well as something sort of warm and charged and mysterious. And, you know, I spent a lot of time in deserts where shade and night are really life-giving, positive forces. And, so that there was that angle as well to rethinking darkness for me.
It seemed to me that there's that both Hope in the Dark and A Paradise Built in Hell seem informed with the same impulse that you can find hope in dark and paradise in hell and so on. And you told me where Hope in the Dark started from. My question is, have you always seen things that way? Or if not, how did that impulse develop?
You know, I didn't. And Paradise in the Hell did not start out as a sister project to Hope in the Dark. It ended up that way, to my surprise. But, you know, I both wrote and researched and read a lot of history, and I lived some of it in the rise of the environmental justice movement and the activism around Seattle 10 years ago and things like that. And so I actually, and just living in the era we live in, I've witnessed a lot of profound change in the status of gay and lesbian people, for example, and other things that really gave me a hopeful sense that popular power and cultural work matter, and that we're in a world that's actually very volatile and uncertain, and there's a lot of room to change it. It's not the kind of fixed-in-place, inevitable, we're all doomed, it's always been this way status quo that a lot of people want to think. And so I'd seen a lot of the stories and been sort of collecting them without realizing it for years before Hope in the Dark arose out of the crisis that required me to kind of catalyze all that into, in some sense, an alternate theory of history.
Mm-hmm. And it seems to me, I mean, I understand what you said, that A Paradise Built in Hell, about how people respond to disasters, didn't seem at first like a companion project. But I must say that the notion that what some perceive as the worst brings out the best.
Yeah, you know, it really began with a question. It was going to be a talk with a question about what is this strange joy that I kept running across in disaster. And I thought it was going to be subversive and anarchic, but I didn't realize it was going to be a joy in civil society and meaningful work and these broader questions of who we are and what we want, that it was really going to connect to a kind of utopianism realized in the most dire circumstances, and a kind of radicalism. I mean, there was an anarchic joy in that it throve in the absence of the status quo, established order, institutional power, but also an anarchic joy in making a society from the ground up and grassroots self-organization, which functioned remarkably well in disasters. And, you know, you really see a lot of individual and collective potential there that we're usually told doesn't exist.
Yeah, and how, I mean, obviously in the time of the last year and a half or so, we've seen an economic disaster. At least we've seen it come home to America in a way that it's come home to other countries along the way. Do you find the same potential in this disaster, and if not, why not?
You know, I think that there is. I think one of the things that's amazing is that we went from being kind of deferential and even reverent about Wall Street and CEOs and billionaires and fat cats and capitalism to having this really kind of snarky, at least, and critical and questioning approach. And that's a radical change. And Time Magazine did a Why Main Street Hates Wall Street cover story without it saying, wow, a year ago nobody felt that way. And so, you know, so there's that. And I've heard a lot of stories, I haven't seen a lot of it in person, of people forming various kinds of communities and solidarities and collectives to survive sudden unemployment, eviction from foreclosed on houses and other things like that. So there's been a lot of organizing and a lot of solidarity. And, you know, there hasn't been any kind of great upheaval and revolution. It felt like there could be for a minute, but everything got smoothed over in this country so that it wasn't like Argentina, for example, where the economy collapsed and then they had a lot of radical political and social change in response.
Mm-hmm. Now, that leads me sort of to the next thing I was going to ask about. It seems to me that as you – and I'm projecting a bit, but as you – came to the realizations, the themes that were buried in the disaster book and in Hope, it seems to me that it actually connected to what's gone on in Latin America over the last, since the appearance of the Zapatistas and so on, that what happened, what you saw, and let me just tell people, in A Paradise Built in Hell, Rebecca Solnit looks at the 1906 San Francisco earthquake, the munitions explosion in Halifax, Nova Scotia. Was that 1917?
Yes.
The 85 Mexico earthquake, Katrina, and 9/11. And in looking at those and some others, but in looking primarily at those is where you find this, as you say, joy, resourcefulness, cooperation, et cetera, et cetera. But it seems to me that when you began to look then at these other things, Seattle versus the WTO, the changes in Latin America and so on, that it seems to me there's a sort of a similar positive alternative.
Yeah, I think what they all have in common is that they're moments of popular power and where civil society kind of becomes self-aware and empowered, where people feel like a part of something larger, feel compelled to act, and in acting find a kind of joy in that power and solidarity and connection in the meaningful work, the meaningful social role that most people don't get every day. Latin America is remarkable because people seem to be able to build on those disaster moments and are permanently radicalized by them, whereas, you know, the moment after 9/11, clearly we were not a competitive commercial society. We're a cooperative society where money didn't matter for a few hours to a few days at the very least. And nobody really said this is not enough people said this is better, this is truer, we don't have to be that way didn't work. Or anything like that. There wasn't a kind of reverse. Whereas in Latin America, people seem to have a, I don't know whether it's literally the language or if it's more romantic revolutionary cultural history, but people seem to be able to seize those moments and build on them in more meaningful and long-lasting ways. You know, and a disaster unfolds a lot like a revolution initially, but you know, then there's a kind of counter-revolution of reestablishing the status quo that's often very aggressive and hostile and a little akin to Naomi Klein's disaster capitalism, but it doesn't always succeed, and there are always counter-forces, even in places like New Orleans where things have not gone so well.
So I was, of course, going to mention Naomi Klein's The Shock Doctrine, in which she says that political forces will seize on disaster, calamity, and so on, to put in, as Milton Friedman said, the ideas that have been lying around. Do you see that both her book and your book are true, or do you see some places where they conflict?
You know, I think that there are some, at the very least, major differences in interpretation. For one thing, it's, you know, I don't think it's particularly revelatory that self-interested oligarchies, capitalists, and et cetera, seek their self-interest at every possible moment and can try and make an opportunity out of anything. But they don't always win. And even in things that, like Katrina, that have gone badly, there's also been a lot of coalition building, a lot of remarkable new community alliances, a lot of consciousness raising. You know, Katrina was really the moment where Bush lost his popular mandate, his credibility, and his own pollster admits that. And so Katrina changed the political tenor in this country for the better immediately. It wasn't all, you know, right-wing and corporate triumph. And, you know, and every disaster has us, you can see us being a little bit like a revolution. It's a struggle between forces. And, you know, for me, hope isn't that we always win or that it's inevitable, but sometimes we win. And in disaster, you can see in Mexico City, in Katrina, in a lot of disasters, these moments of, can you tell I'm out of doors?
Yes, I like it.
there's these moments of popular power and often a power struggle. And, you know, okay, the dogs were barking quite loudly. The salmon are quite amazing. Sometimes we win. you're live from the wild streams of the North Bay. Salmon reporter?
That's what I was just going to say. The voices you hear are those of the dogs.
Yeah. Okay,
near Rebecca Solnit.
Swim upstream in popular history. We'll leave out the spawning metaphors.
Right. I just wanted to throw a quote that you throw, which is that from Thomas Paine, when he says, "The instant formal government is abolished, society begins to act." And that, yeah. you also talk about the elite panic. Can you talk about,
yes,
how those two things fit together?
Well, you know, the elite panic, as it's described by the people who coined the term, Karen Chess and Lee Clark, is essentially about the fact that ordinary people don't panic. One of the things I do in this book is try and take on a lot of the myths of disaster, that ordinary people revert to some sort of barbaric, Hobbesian, social Darwinist, chaotic, competitive nature. We revert to our original nature in disaster, which is a philosophical, not a scientific position. And then that original nature, if you want to see it that way, seems to be altruistic, generous, resourceful, creative, and brave. But elites don't, an assumption, part of the assumption of disaster capitalism is that we're overwhelmed and they're not. But it's also another way around. And you look at how paralyzed Bush was by 9/11. You look at a lot of these things, and the people most invested in the status quo are often the ones who are shocked and confused. And unfortunately, they also have disproportionate power, and they often use it very badly. Elite panic is about the breaking of social bonds in which people in power, and Katrina is a great example of this, are willing to use inappropriate and extreme force in the protection of private property, in which they assume that the issue is to regain control rather than to protect human life, and in which they often militarize and turn violent and divisive, a disaster that in no way is needed to be that way.
Yeah, the disaster you start with, the 1906 earthquake in San Francisco. We know that Katrina is the one that we know from television recently, but similar and worse happened in 1906 in San Francisco. Yes,
I'm not sure I'd say it was worse, because the racial element in Katrina was so brutal, and because the stranding of all those thousands of people.
Yes.
Completely unnecessarily in horrific conditions for 5 days on while the whole world watched. I don't think there's been anything quite like it, except things like the Vietnamese boat people crises and stuff like that. But the 1906 earthquake, for people who aren't willing to believe the radical interpretation of Katrina, you know, it's so similar in that the U.S. Army freaks out, assumes that the public is out of control and that their job is to get the public back into control. They march in and essentially act as though martial law has been declared. They exhibit that enthusiasm that we also saw in Katrina to use deadly force in the protection of minor private property. You know, and there is this bizarre thing in disaster where they're willing to essentially administer the death penalty without trial for minor property crimes.
Right, yeah. That suddenly the rules have changed in that direction.
Yeah, and so, but so in 1906, so the military, with the encouragement of the mayor who issued a shoot-to-kill order for looters and various National Guards, armed cadets from UC Berkeley, all kind of stormed in the name of taking the city under control, and they were essentially the forces that were out of control. They attempted to create fire breaks that actually lit a lot of the city on fire. They prevented citizens from fighting that broke out with the earthquake, or responsible for burning a lot of they promised how they actually assaulted, killed people, murdered them around like sheep.
Let me ask you something, Rebecca. Rebecca, you're breaking up more. Have you moved, or does that mean the battery is probably starting to fade?
I think I've moved.
Oh, okay. Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Let me finally, we may move away from the discussion of disasters and that book towards the half point here, but one of the lines that I end up writing for myself, and it comes up a few times, is everyday life the real disaster? And one that what we perceive as disaster can wake us from?
You know, that was my argument. And there's a tendency when we talk about disasters to pretend everything was rosy in the moment before the earthquake or the hurricane or the bomb hit. And, you know, and we know it's not so. People suffer and die in isolation or individually every day, and that we live in a society where a lot of people feel marginalized, feel powerless, feel voiceless, et cetera. There are a lot of catastrophes of everyday life in a lot of societies. I think in a society where people had no isolation, alienation, and powerlessness, a disaster is truly only a disaster. But for many people, a disaster is an occasion where they overcome many of the disasters of everyday life, even though they're facing other disasters, including, you know, the loss of the basic material systems by which they survive, and the economy, the physical structure, and that there's been, you know, deaths and loss and tragedy. And it's important here to say that although I find these remarkable things in disasters, it's not that I'm pro-disaster. Disasters are, first of all, devastating, deadly, you know, and to be avoided whenever possible. What I hoped to do with the book is give people a sense of what's possible in other times when you see what's possible in disasters.
Right.
Kind of prepared, you know, some equipment for thinking about everyday life and how different it could be, both because it is different in these moments and because the joy you see is how fulfilled people are by being in a social moment that gives them more connection, more purpose, more meaningful work. So, and I also wanted to dispel some of the myths of disaster, that we revert to those Hobbesian hordes that were an essentially competitive, vicious species, and then only the threat of institutional violence keeps us from, you know, gnawing on each other's limbs or whatever your Hobbesian fear scenario is.
Right, and it, that's what it seems to me, is that the message in this book is, you know, yes, you're picking these headline moments, but the message is there's been an interpretation of human nature put out that this book and the experiences counter, and that that new way of looking at human nature is the thing which we can carry into our everyday lives. Let me also read a quote from you. There's a Buddhist paradigm I find much more useful, which is that suffering is inherent. A certain amount of suffering is a given in this world. Old age, sickness, and death are built into it. So the question is not how you avoid it, which is what Americans are always trying to do, but how you are going to respond to it. Paradise lies in forming a meaningful and even a beautiful response.
Yeah, I think that one, you know, I think of Americans as bitter optimists and other parts of the world as cheerful pessimists.
I like
that. You know, you go to a lot of parts of the world and people don't assume that they have a God-given right or a, you know, constitutionally ordained right to be rich, beautiful, happy, sexually fulfilled, and lead a life of ease and even luxury. And a lot of Americans are, you know, really unhappy because, eternally youthful? And a lot of Americans seem unhappy because they don't have those things. And it's like, you know, most people on Earth aren't going to have most of those things. Most of us in this country are luckier than most people on Earth. And the question is not how to line up all these acquisitive ducks in a row, but how to deal, you know, this, we're now getting into sort of Buddhist and philosophical territory, not disaster response territory, but how to cope more gracefully with it. And what's interesting is you see that suddenly that isn't what makes people happy necessarily, since we have, most of us have a lot of those things a lot of the time. And then suddenly in this moment of disaster where everything's uncertain and we have a lot less materially and we're much more aware of mortality and we may have just lost our homes or even our cities, people are often exuberant. And they're exuberant because the moment is demanding, because they have something meaningful to do, because they're doing it in solidarity with others, because people who, you know, the day before, the hour before seemed strangers they had nothing in common with are now the people they're, you know, united with and stuff. And it's not, you know, and that moment can't last, but it does suggest what we can be and what we want. And those, I think, are important things.
Right. I'm going to read again your words. You say the overarching thesis is the recovery of this purpose and closeness without crisis or pressure is the great contemporary task of being human. You're also an activist as well as a writer, which I find is not always the case. And let me just read a couple of quotes and then have you talk about that. One is, you said, I spend a lot of time as an activist in the streets. In those moments, I've discovered in myself and in others a deep happiness, an unknown desire that's finally fulfilled to be purposeful, to be a part of history and society, to have a voice. And then you say everything is political, and the choice to be apolitical is usually just an endorsement of the status quo and the unexamined life. How do you mix writing about things and being an activist?
You know, more and more I hope that my writing is my activism, particularly the stuff I do for TomDispatch.com, which has enormous reach and immediacy. But my younger brother, David, I did the Seattle WTO book with, is a dedicated organizer who does a remarkable work. And I always feel like I'm kind of floating off in the clouds, and he's always pulling me back into the streets. So I'm luckier than a lot of writers in that I have that kind of built-in balancing mechanism. That, so that's been a huge part of my activist life.
Right. And that book, by the way, for people
on my own.
Oh, I was just going to say, that book for people is The Battle of the Story of the Battle of Seattle, which Rebecca co-authored with David Solnit, and in which they look at how various interpretations of what happened those days in Seattle have been put forward, and they try to get it right. And one of the things that you say, again, you say a lot of the time our achievement is nothing to look at. It's the species that didn't go extinct, the dissident who wasn't executed, the civil liberties that didn't matter. And that's one of the things that you feel, I think, that people miss along the way.
I'm sorry, I missed the last thing. That's one of the things that what?
Well, that people miss because they either are looking for the big victory or they're looking at what the media decides to talk about. And you said that the achievements that give you hope and give you the sense that our life has actually, I mean, there's a point where you say our life has so radically been transformed for the positive over the last 30 or 40 years in ways that we don't notice because it's often, as I read your quote, the species that didn't go extinct or the dissident who wasn't executed or the civil liberties that didn't wither, the wetland that didn't become a mall.
Yeah, since we're coming up on Christmas, I'll use my It's a Wonderful Life analogy. With most of the listeners probably know that move, that corny movie where Jimmy Stewart's guardian angel shows him what the world would have been like if he'd never been born. All this terrible stuff that would have happened differently would have never happened. And it makes him feel very different about this small role he's played in small-town life and gives him a sense of mattering and...
Are you doing one of those looking back from the end of 2009 this year?
You know, I'm really not because with Copenhagen unresolved for another week or more, we're in a moment of such utter uncertainty and that what does or doesn't come out of that really determines the fate of the world. And so I don't feel quite the same.
Mm-hmm.
And Obama is also such a wild card. And, you know, when you talk about that amazing spirit in disasters, that desire to be part of something larger, et cetera, there was that amazing movement around him, you know, a little more than a year ago that, you know, I think has left a lot of people feeling extremely crestfallen since then. And on the climate change, it looks like he's doing the conventional thing, which is not nearly what we need to do. And so, but I don't know, you know, in a sense, I feel more uncertain. And hopeful in a way because of that radical uncertainty. So I'm kind of like spinning my wheels here. But essentially, I'm not sure. I'm doing a piece for Tom Dispatch that will be out in a week, though. I had a remarkable experience a few weeks ago. I was sick with the flu in a hotel within view of the Superdome in New Orleans while watching Terminator 2. And there's something about looking at yesterday's visions of the apocalypse and looking out the window at the contemporary version, it was very rich in that. So I'm trying to use Terminator 2 as a guide to navigate the future.
Okay. And
the fact that Arnold Schwarzenegger is our sort of green Terminator governor going to Copenhagen this week as well does help tie it all together. It was very strange watching the movie, which I'd never seen before, just in part because, you know, the action hero in the movie is the real-life guy who's, you know, carrying out a lot of our climate change agenda for California. And California is kind of doing more than most states and has done a lot of great stuff, which doesn't make Arnold Schwarzenegger a flawless human being or a noble politician, but it makes him damn interesting.
Mm-hmm. I agree, yes. One of the things that some people have said, the message that whatever Obama does is obviously critical, but that the message of the states and municipalities of the United States to Copenhagen or about climate change is a much more positive, much more realistic approach than if you just look at what the federal government is doing.
You know, one of the beautiful things that happened during the Bush years, you didn't hear much about, although I tried to write about it a few times, is that there was so much disaffection with what was happening at the federal level that a lot of states and municipalities essentially began setting their own policy and setting really progressive policy comparatively on climate change and things like that. And, you know, and I like that. I like leadership and initiative and, you know, and power devolving from the center to the grassroots and the margins and the whole. And Bush produced a lot of strange unintentional effects of radicalizing people, of redistributing power, of making the feds a little bit irrelevant in some ways and things like that. But that was a really interesting moment. And, of course, Obama ran on this sort of Cesar Chavez piece of quite a populist rhetoric and becomes this consolidating figure. So I still don't even know what to think about him.
Yeah, I have had, obviously, on the air and off conversations, many about that. One of my own feelings has been that, and I think it's something to which you were sort of referring there, is that in the worst of the Bush years, I was not as disheartened. I might have been angry,
but
there's a kind of a sadness that I have felt, and maybe it's I think it's also a truly a wake up call, but a kind of sadness in Obama's response to things, where I had no I was going to say no hope in this conversation, but I kind of accepted Bush and Cheney are going to do this, we must do this and be ready for what's next and do this locally and so on. With Obama, there's more feeling that, wait a minute, we worked so hard, we did this, and now it's just so unsatisfying.
But you have to remember, I imagine John McCain as president with Sarah Palin as president, and speaking of the terrible things that didn't happen, and you'll feel better right away. And what's interesting about Obama is that there's all these strange little things that most people aren't kind of nerdy enough to track, appointments, policies that were finally acting on policies, and for one thing on climate change, is that they stopped interfering with California's ability to regulate climate change gases under EPA rules, and instead went ahead and turned those into federal rules. Sandra Sotomayor questioned the basis of corporate personhood early in her job on the Supreme Court. Monsanto has been looked at in terms of antitrust legislation. And these are really kind of amazing things. And what I say to people, and this is not as somebody who's like gaga about Obama and thinks he's flawless and perfect, but if when the war broke out, I had said to you, hey, don't get totally freaked out, because in about 5.5 years, we're going to elect.
I just lost you there. Are you back, Rebecca?
It's a random universe.
It is a random universe. So,
but it's a random universe with spawning co-host Sam, and it's the good news.
That's right. That's right. How many other people got good news this morning? You know?
Yeah, this must sound like completely lunatic non sequiturs to your listenership, but maybe they're used to that.
Let me ask you, if it's not too much of a challenge. As I told you, one of my favorite questions, and I've only asked it in the 13 years I've been doing this show, I've only asked it probably 10 times or so, which is to ask someone if you could stand in the future at the year 2025 or 2030 at this point and look back, did humanity turn things around? And the you can almost fill in the blanks there. Did they turn around their penchant for inequity and domination, their abuse of the environment, the ways that genders relate. There's lots of things that resort to violence, et cetera, et cetera. Did humanity turn things around? And if the answer is no, then that's a very difficult answer. But if the answer is yes, how did they do it? And ask people actually to imagine what some of the turning points and were in the 25 years looking forward. And you're one person that I feel I can ask that of, because you've actually written it. Now, you wrote it in 2006, so that was while Bush was still in office, before the Obama election, before the crash of 08, before a few other things. But if I were to ask you now, do you think the answer from 2025 or 2030 is humanity turned things around? And the answer is yes. How did we do it?
You know, of course, I believe in radical uncertainty. That piece from a few years ago was called The Age of Mammals, because it's about going to go see a dinosaur exhibit with kids while dinosaurs ID forces, kind of like modern-day corporations that ruled the Earth. And mammals were like these little, tiny, trivial, irrelevant things that you wouldn't look at that and think that an age of mammals were coming, which reptiles would be pretty subsidiary, but it was. That it's the small things that you don't see coming that may matter immensely, may change the world. I think if we're going to make it, we need a lot of grassroots, civil society, popular power around climate change. We need to reimagine where we are now and where we need to be, rather than as giving up privilege and luxury, as giving up alienation and corrosion. My friend Bill McKibben's book, Deep Economy, I think is a really wonderful vision of what our societies need to look like in a sustainable world. And we always think that this is going to be about giving stuff up, and definitely there will be less third homes and jet skis and private jets and things like that. But there will be less alienation and isolation and poverty and inequity and things like that. That, you know, his vision is of a lot of local economies where village and city life is tied to agriculture, where people are connected to the physical and social processes that make the world they live in, where a lot of the problems of our world now, which to me...
Lost her for a second. I'll pick up the ball. One of the things that I have noticed is that where we have been driving with this market global capitalism approach, and as one point at which she says it's like a car being driven by a drunk who's out of control, is we had two things that from World War II certainly on, but even before, were huge drivers. One was this global free trade agenda, in which you would grow things wherever you could grow them the cheapest and make things wherever you could make them the cheapest, and then you would ship them all over the world so that our food averages traveling something like 1,300 miles to our plate. On the other side of that, it was a fossil fuel-driven economy. And when you put free trade and fossil fuel together, and then you look at the realities we're facing now with peak oil, climate change, and the breakdowns of market capitalism, you can see that localism and decentralization, which is a rewriting of the last 60 years, is actually turns out to be so often the answer to so many of our questions. You're back, Rebecca?
I am back, and I want to apologize to you and the listeners for all these interruptions at you know, but it was for the sake of seeing the salmon, and they have been lovely. So, where were we when I got cut off?
Well, I think you were just at the point where localism is the good news. And what I was saying was, just to catch you up with what I said very briefly, was that the fossil fuel-driven economy and the global free trade economy depend on each other being viable. And that what it always looked to me as I was watching that was, wait, we're going to run out of oil, we're running into climate change, and there's no reason, you know, food should travel 1,300 miles to our plates. And that these two things had outlived their usefulness, and that localism, decentralization, is very likely to be the hope of the future.
You know, I feel a contribution that the book that I just did has for that is that it's not the ecological and economic arguments that something like McKibben's Deep Economy makes. It's saying that we can do this anarchic, decentralized, grassroots form of self-government, and that we take enormous joy in it, that there's enormous promise there for people to lead lives that are more, have more agency, more voice, and I think more joy. That this is really what this is who people really want to be. This is what they really want to do.
And as you point out, this is who, in the crucible of crisis, they tend to become. They tend to show.
Yeah.
So you're saying this is also, we
already know how to do it. And you know, like in a disaster, people improvise rescues and shelters and community kitchens and first aid stations and pool their skills and figure stuff out, but they're very good at this improvising. They're very good at taking new roles. They're very, you know, that and they take great satisfaction in that kind of work. And that, I think, is incredibly encouraging, because we're entering an era where we're going to have far more disasters and far more intense disasters. I think we need to be prepared for them, partly by getting over our fear of disaster, our fear that we're reverting to Hobbesian wars of each against each, and partly to recognize what kinds of opportunities can be seized from the maelstrom. And there are opportunities to form better societies and more meaningful lives out of this task. And it's, you know, so I think joy is what I have to contribute to the argument that we need to change, but also that we can change, and that maybe even we want to change.
Right. No, I think, by the way, that's what I took from that book as well, that by examining human nature, so much of what we talk about now is we look at nature in terms of climate change or that sort of thing, but human nature, that in fact, heading where it looks like we're heading, even with all that uncertainty that we face, that your book really says, wait a minute, we can do this. We are the people who can do this. I know that in McKibben's book, one of the things that stuck out for me, and it also comes up in Michael Pollan's work and so on, is that buying food at a farmer's market is a socially enlivening and a socially fulfilling experience, that there are many more conversations and relationships that develop versus buying food in a supermarket, that people will go an entire time in a supermarket, have not one conversation, very much different in a farmer's market. That also said, there's a benefit to this localism. There's a benefit to scaling down. You're saying that at a very deep level, there's a joyful aliveness that's there as well.
I feel like a lot of my work has been about trying to describe the unquantifiable, and we're very good at talking about convenience, efficiency, and profit. We have a much harder time taking stock of the measurable forces of sort of joy, pleasure, satisfaction, and belonging, but that something like a farmer's market gives you and an automated checkout Safeway doesn't, and that we need to learn to speak those other languages as part of the effort to change the world. And this is, I think, poetry and imagination and creative descriptions play a huge role.
Okay. I think we're going to wrap it at that and let you go. And I'll tell you what, maybe sometime in the coming year we'll do this again. And
and I promise to do it from my landline.
We'll do it on a landline, and people will go, oh, God, that's so easy. You can listen to
well,
this
thank
week.
Thank you for bearing with me.
Oh, thank you very much.
I have to report that the coho salmon are having an amazing day.
There you go. So that was something that we hadn't expected and my listeners hadn't expected. Thank you very much, Rebecca Solnit. Keep up the good work.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others anytime during the week by linking to the podcast. You can also sign up to have it delivered to you weekly for podcasts, articles, and transcripts of interviews. And to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to TerrenceMcNally.net. That's one word, Terrence McNally. .net. And if you want to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on and what we're going to talk about, email me at temcnally@mac.com.